It is 8:09 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. And we're going to drill down into what is turning into an international controversy over the very likely death, very likely execution of Saudi expatriate journalist Jamal Khashoggi. This is a person who is of the Saudi political establishment, but has been critical while writing from abroad as a columnist for the Washington Post of the current government of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He, 12 days ago, walks into a Saudi consulate in Turkey in order to pull papers he needs to get married. And as far as anyone can tell, never walks out again. The best reporting on what we think happened has been in the Washington Post, where he was working as a columnist. They appear to have verified their sourcing with both Turkish and U.S. intelligence officials. They are saying that the Turkish officials were able to intercept an audio and perhaps video recording that was made on Khashoggi's iWatch while he was inside the consulate. They believe he was tortured, killed, and dismembered by a collection of 15 to 16 Saudi nationals who came in on a charter flight that day and left the same day. The question is, what happens next? These accounts have been so credible, and he was a journalist of such prominence, that it has prompted some movement in U.S. political circles, where a lot of other fairly atrocious acts by the Saudi government have not. Over the weekend, early in the weekend, Donald Trump said if it's true, there could be, quote, severe punishment for Saudi Arabia. Marco Rubio, you heard during our news break, was on the weekend talk shows talking about congressional action on this issue that would be, quote, nearly unanimous. It's going to be swift and it's going to go pretty far. And we have already seen in the face of the Saudi government warning that it would respond to any U.S. action with greater action, a retreat from Donald Trump, who's now raising concerns about the price tag on what he is describing as a $110 billion arms deal and what it would mean for the United States to have that canceled. Thought this would be a good time to explore the ties between the Saudi government and the U.S. government, in particular, some of the key figures inside the Trump administration. We're joined on the line by Ben Freeman. He is director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, let's start out with what appears to be almost certainly the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. What is the likelihood that the head of state, Mohammed bin Salman, knew or was involved in ordering something like this? Like, how much plausible deniability does he have?
I mean, for Mohammed bin Salman, it's very, very likely that he, at the very least, knew about this. After all, Mohammed bin Salman was one of the architects of the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. He is, very, very much integrated into Saudi military and intelligence issues. So the idea that the Crown Prince had no idea about this, that really strains credibility.
So when figures like Marco Rubio and even Donald Trump start talking about some kind of punishment or sanction of Saudi Arabia, what does that actually mean? What does the U.S. have it within its power to do? And what would Republicans mean by sanctioning Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, the U.S. actually has quite a few options here. The option that a lot of Republicans are actually talking about and leading with would be sanctions related to the Magnitsky Act. It was named after Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian whistleblower who was then tortured and killed by the Russians. And it basically allows us to sanction a country for precisely what we've seen here and what we saw with Sergei Magnitsky, too. But in addition to that, there's a few other options that Congress can choose to use. That's to block future arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Trump keeps touting those, the $110 billion figure he keeps throwing out is a complete fabrication, by the way. He keeps throwing that out. But Congress has within its power to block those arms sales. They also have within their power, it's in the House, Congressional Resolution 138. It's a war powers resolution that would stop the U.S. from being involved in the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen.
There were mostly providing logistical support, rearming, and mid-air refueling for Saudi bombers, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. But what sort of gets lost in the fray on this is that a lot of the bombs that the Saudis are using, they're U.S.-made bombs. And some of our biggest military contractors are the ones making these bombs. And CNN recently did an expose on it, and they found that a lot of these airstrikes are killing civilians, and they found U.S.-made bombs at the site of multiple airstrikes involving civilian casualties in Yemen.
So with the arms sales, it's never been clear to me, is the United States doing Saudi Arabia a favor by selling it state-of-the-art weapons, or is the incredibly wealthy Saudi government doing U.S. politicians a favor by placing really inflated orders with politically connected arms manufacturers?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the answer is a little bit of both. There is a military, a strategic benefit to the U.S. being the arms provider to Saudi Arabia. And what a lot of folks are missing in this debate right now, particularly the president's missing in this debate, is that the Saudis can't just overnight say, well, we're not going to buy this U.S. equipment anymore, these U.S. bombs. You know, we're going to buy them from the Russians or the Chinese. Two problems with that. Problem number one is that American military equipment is better than Russian and Chinese military equipment. And then number two, there's this issue, the wonky term we use is interoperability. And what that basically means is that the Russian and Chinese equipment, it can't directly operate with other U.S. equipment. And so if the Saudis were going to stop buying arms from the U.S., it would take years, perhaps even decades, for them to fully cross over to a Russian or a Chinese system.
So when the Saudi government talks about responding with quote-unquote greater action, are they talking about canceling arms purchases, or are they talking about something else?
I have no idea, actually. That was one of the more ominous comments I thought you could make. If greater action is just stopping arms sales, then why not just say that we're gonna stop buying arms from the U.S. Or if greater action means that we're gonna sever some economic ties or something related to oil, why not just say that? The wording of greater action there, I think, was really unnecessarily foreboding.
Walk us through what triggering Magnitsky Act sanctions would entail. First of all, is it something that the Congress can do on its own initiative if the president's not inclined to?
Yeah, so Congress could, as it's looking right now, I think, as you indicated, Marco Rubio was right in that Congress is really, they're united on this, which is phenomenal to me, coming off of, the Brett Kavanaugh hearing where Congress was just unbelievably divided along partisan lines. We really haven't seen this level of unity among Democrats and Republicans in Congress on an issue in quite a long time. And so regardless of what Trump may or may not want Congress to do, they're going to have the votes to override a veto of anything they do that Trump might want to veto. That would include the Magnitsky Act. That would include the Yemen War Powers Resolution that I mentioned. That would also include the arms sales authorization. So Trump has kind of put himself in a bind here. And so the fact that he keeps opposing Congress on this, and he seems to really be the lone outlier this morning, indicating that this might have been rogue killers and not Saudi Arabia, that just doesn't stand up to the facts. And it's not going to hold up in Congress either.
So why? I mean, why would Donald Trump be going against his party on that? He hasn't taken a strong interest in foreign policy otherwise.
Yeah. That's a great question. And that's one that here at the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, we've dug into pretty heavily in trying to figure out what we affectionately call the Trump's love affair with Saudi Arabia. And what we found is that over the course of the Trump administration, actually even before he became president, the Saudis were courting Donald Trump extremely heavily. For more than two decades, he's been doing business there. Just during the course of his campaign, Trump Inc. started eight new businesses in Saudi Arabia related to hotels there. And when he became president, they really doubled down on their lobbying and PR blitz to court the Trump administration, and they did a very effective job of it. They apparently, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have now become very good friends. I heard reports recently that they communicate on a daily basis. So the level of connection that the Saudis have garnered from the Trump administration, it's really extraordinary right now.
And why do you think that is? Do they have business ties? There's been a lot of remarks Donald Trump has made about how much he enjoys selling condominiums to Saudis.
Right. Yeah. He famously said, he loves selling condominiums to the Saudis. And these are not cheap condominiums either. He mentioned some of these are $30, $40, and $50 billion condos. Even in D.C. or San Francisco, that would be a giant condo. But it goes well beyond that. He's got the personal business ties with Saudi Arabia, sure. But a lot of it is Trump sees Saudi Arabia as appealing to, some of his worst vices. When he goes to Saudi Arabia on his first foreign trip as president, by the way, they roll out the red carpet for him, throw multi-million dollar parties for him. He literally had a seat there that looked a lot like a throne. And so appealing to, his sort of darker nature. And then back here in the U.S., they hire a lot of lobbyists, and firms that were connected to Trump and have folks working at the firms that were part of Trump's inner circle. And what we've also found is that a lot of those lobbyists, they're working Congress as well, and they're making campaign contributions to a lot of the exact same members they're contacting on behalf of the Saudis. And they're doing it very regularly. We tracked over $400,000 in campaign contributions that they made to members of Congress that they personally contacted on behalf of the Saudis.
Donald Trump's envoy to Saudi Arabia up to this point has been Jared Kushner. Jared Kushner, someone Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, current ruler, someone who's done a lot of power consolidation, described as, quote unquote, in my pocket. What do we know about their relationship?
I'd say it's a very uncomfortable relationship if you're following it. Basically, this is one of those things that started very early on in the Trump administration again. And back then, Mohammed bin Salman, he was not Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He was the son of the king, but he was not the first in line to the throne. That was his cousin. And so Trump goes on this lavish trip to Saudi Arabia in May of that year. What was very, very underreported in the U.S. press was that not even a month later, Mohammed bin Salman launches what is quite literally a palace coup in Saudi Arabia, where he kidnaps his cousin, the crown prince at the time. And it's not clear exactly what he did, if he tortured him. But by the end of the night, his cousin had renounced his claim to the throne, had renounced himself as being crown prince. And Mohammed bin Salman then effectively took the title that night. And reportedly, Trump declared that we've got our man on top there now, and lauded it as a great victory. Fast forward, and Jared Kushner allegedly fed Mohammed bin Salman the names of some folks in the Saudi royal family who had opposed that move and were not a fan of Mohammed bin Salman's power grab. And then Mohammed bin Salman then rounds up all of those folks. He brings them to the Ritz-Carlton there, holds them captive, and allegedly some of those folks were tortured in the Ritz-Carlton. And by the way, that's the same Ritz-Carlton that there was going to be a giant, there was planned to be a Davos in the Desert economic conference later this month, which a lot of American firms have now pulled out of.
But it's still on.
It is still on, which is after everything that's come out in the media, it's so shocking to me that there are any businesses left who would say, yeah, we still want to do business in Saudi Arabia after the way they treated journalists like this. I'm frankly shocked that it's still on.
Well, it does beg the question. I mean, there have been reports of Mohammed bin Salman rounding up his potential political rivals, torturing them, confiscating their assets to increase his own wealth and power for months now. He's been waging this war in Yemen that has claimed tens of thousands of lives and created what is probably the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world right now. Why is it one journalist getting likely killed and dismembered in a Saudi consulate that has suddenly turned world opinion?
I really think the case of Jamal Khashoggi here is that the Saudis really took it to the next level here in terms of the depravity. And even though it is just one journalist, it's one journalist who was killed in a foreign country. You know, he's killed in a diplomatic consulate. And it's frankly, for better or worse, it's the story behind it. This is a guy that was going to the consulate with his girlfriend, who he wanted to marry. And he's purely going to the consulate to get the paperwork he needs just so this guy can get married. And he never comes out of the consulate, and his girlfriend is waiting for him outside, and then she never sees him again. And if folks haven't read her op-ed in the Washington Post about this, it's absolutely heartbreaking. And it's a shame it took so long for America and the rest of the world to wake up to what Saudi Arabia was doing. But I think we owe it to Jamal Khashoggi and his girlfriend to make sure that there's justice for him.
So we've been talking up to this point about U.S.-Saudi relations and how this incident appears to be changing them. What about Saudi-Turkish relationships? This incident has got to be unfolding with a lot more political valence inside Turkey since it happened on their land.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And Turkish and Saudi relations haven't been good, to put it mildly. And I think what you're seeing with Turkey right now is that they're, for better or for worse, they're taking full advantage of a huge Saudi fiasco on their soil. The Turks were actually holding a U.S. pastor now for almost 2 years, I believe. They just released him in the middle of this. And so I think Turkey is really looking at this as a way to kind of reset relationships with the U.S. And to punish what's sort of been a kind of frenemy rival in Saudi Arabia at the same time.
All right. Ben Freeman, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thanks for having me.